From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Those are just a few of my neighbors. First I watched them just to kill time, but then I couldn't take my eyes off them, just as you would be able to.
Proposition for invasion of your privacy.
Right away to my privacy.
Oh no.
Yeah, I need my privacy.
I'm a race of peeping Toms. What people ought to do is get outside their own house and look in for a change. Yes, sir. How's that for a bit of homespun philosophy?
Reader's Digest, April 1939.
Well, I only quote from the best.
As you may guess from that mashup, we're taking a close-up look at privacy today. Filmmaker Marina Lutz tells us about her documentary, The Marina Experiment, which chronicles her discovery that her father was a voyeur and that she was the focus of his attention. Also, Chuck Klosterman shares his personal experience of voyeurism. We'll try to come up with a good definition of privacy, and we'll look at the flip side of privacy, peep culture. But first, have you posted any personal information online lately? Maybe a photo of yourself enjoying a beer. Maybe a Match.com profile in which you didn't mention that you have kids. It may seem harmless, but what we post online can be found by employers, schools, and lawyers, and the results can be disastrous. People have lost jobs and even custody of children when an unwise post made it into the wrong hands. Laurie Andrews is the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. In her book, she describes Facebook as Facebook Nation. She tells Anne Strainchamps why.
Well, it actually has a population that would make it the third largest nation in the world after China and India. And yet, if you think about it, what are its rules? It has an economy. It actually has Facebook money. It has citizens. It has relationships with other nations. And yet, instead of having a constitution, it has rules that switch at a moment's notice. So Facebook used to promise that everything you did would be private. And then in 2009, it decided to make your friends public. And that had repercussions around the world. There were U.S. critics of Tehran who had Facebook pages where they had friended friends and relatives in Iran. And when their friends' pictures and names became public, those friends were picked up in Iran by the police, beat up, and so forth. So rules switch with respect to Facebook, and people don't know how what they post might actually come back to haunt them.
So are you saying that thinking of Facebook as a nation and realizing that we all, to a greater or lesser extent, have become citizens of this Facebook nation is a way of beginning to think more critically of the structures and rules or lack of rules that govern our behavior in Facebook
yes.
nation?
There are really important rules that you'd have in any other setting. And so if you think of my offline self as being regulated by national laws, why not have regulations for my online self? So certain protections that I have. Everybody's familiar with how health information is protected when it's in the hands of doctors or in the hands of hospitals. They can't just disclose and so forth. But if I say on Facebook, even on my private page of Facebook, that I'm thinking of getting pregnant, or if I like the American Cancer Society, an employer who would otherwise hire me might not, based on the idea that I could charge a lot to their health insurance. So things that are forbidden, asking a potential employee if she's planning to get pregnant or if cancer runs in her family, are not protected online. So thinking about Facebook as a nation is a way to start people thinking and demanding their rights online.
So basically you're saying that unlike Las Vegas, what happens in Facebook doesn't stay in Facebook.
Absolutely not. And so 75% of employers now require their human resource people to check your online presence before offering you a job. And 24% of employers or more say that they've turned down people for having a drink in their hand on their Facebook photo, even an innocent wine glass at a wedding for someone who is over 21. I think of poor Ashley Payne. She was a high school teacher, 24 years old, on summer vacation. She went to Ireland. She posted, as many young people do on Facebook, 700 photos of her vacation. In 10 of them, she had wine or beer in her hand, including on the tour of the Guinness factory. And they're very, very innocent photos. She's not drunk at all. She's toasting someone. She's on this tour. Lost her job as a result of it, even though, as a high school teacher, she hadn't friended any students or any parents of students where they might have claimed she was setting a bad example. So here is something that perfectly legal behavior gets her into trouble.
So that just seems wrong. Did that case or do cases like it go to courts? What have the courts decided?
Courts have not caught up with social networks. And so courts have said you have no right to privacy in anything you post. In fact, a New York judge said even your emails should be thought of like a postcard, that you have no privacy rights over them. That could be made public. Now, think about that for a moment. I'm a lawyer. I might email clients. I certainly don't want that public. I think there's an attorney-client privilege I don't want to lose. And I think we should equally be thought to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in what we do on the websites. Now we're disclosing there even more private information than we'd ever before talked about to third parties. People talk about on a typical Facebook page their political preferences, their sexual preferences. In fact, Richard Power, a security analyst, said, think about if the government tried to get that sort of very, very intimate information, everything you've ever bought, everything you believe in. He said it would take money, it would take lawyers, it might even take guns. But we freely give it, and this is fascinating, 93% of the time when the government asks Google for our private information, Google turns it over.
On the other hand, isn't this what privacy settings are for? I mean, can't people just adjust their privacy settings and keep all that stuff private?
On social networks like Facebook, you didn't used to have privacy settings. It was only when they started to get Google Envy and Google Plus came out with abilities to restrict who you showed things through that Facebook put privacy settings in. But now employers in Maryland and Montana have gotten sneaky, and they've started asking people for their passwords to Facebook. I was recently at a signing ceremony with Governor Pat Quinn in Illinois. He asked me to speak there because Illinois and Maryland have now passed laws saying it is illegal for your employer to ask for your social network password.
Wow. What happens if an employee in one of those states refuses, says, no, my social network is private, you can't see it?
Are you really going to get the job then? The idea is you're hiding something. See, I'm less worried about that almost than coercion. How can I say no, really, if I know there are 50 people in competition for the job in a tough market? There's another whole layer to this. Beyond what we post, data aggregators collect information about what we've done on the web, not just what we've posted on social networks, but what we've searched for in internet searches, what websites we've been to, how much time we spent on the page. And there are a variety of companies. There's one called Axiom that for 96% of Americans has 1,500 pieces of information, including what pharmaceuticals you take and so forth.
Wait. You mean for you and for me, this company probably has 1,500 pieces of information about each of us?
Yes. And so how it gets it is you visit a website, and that website puts web beacons, cookies, other sort of tracking mechanisms that then follow you all over the web. It is astonishing because, I mean, we might think, okay, I can be careful. I don't need to put up those drunken hot tub photos. I don't need to like strange biker gangs. You know, I can clean up my own Facebook page in a way.
Be careful not to diss my employer on my Facebook page.
Yeah. But what about the fact that in addition to writing nonfiction about social networks, I write mystery books? So my Google searches, I actually invented a date rape drug for one book and I blew up the White House in another one. Well, if that is readily available to people, as it is through these cookies, whole criminal cases have been based on Google searches that people have done.
You're kidding. For example?
Say my sister. I love my sister, but she disappears. Maybe she's gone off, you know, to start a new life. But if I've looked at, like, the depth of a nearby lake, that's the sort of thing that they consider problematic. Or if I've done searches for different types of weapons, which I have for my mysteries. I love writing books. I love dictionary.com. It puts 233 tracking mechanisms on my computer.
Just from the words you've looked up in the dictionary?
From before even that, just going to the website. And so websites work like that. I mean, sometimes it's to your advantage. So Amazon.com will have a tracking mechanism that will remember your credit card if you want, or remember that you like mysteries, or that you love my recent book, that sort of thing. And so to your advantage. But other sites just go on and aggregate based on the words that you've used in an email, based on the words that you've used in a web search. So say I write to my sister, who I've already told you I adore, and I say I'm thinking of getting a divorce through my Gmail account. That's actually scanned, and ads are based on that, and that information is collected as a data point about me. Or if I go on a website and look up old guitars, so I've done those two things. Now I go on a credit card site. I will be offered a less good credit card, if I'm offered any credit card at all, based on the fact that people who are likely to get a divorce are less likely to pay off their credit card bills, and people who are in garage rock bands don't have that much money.
How have people's social network posts entered the courtroom? I mean, to what extent are posts on Facebook actually used in trials as evidence?
It's now an astonishingly high percentage of family law cases. And I particularly see it used against women. If you've posted a sexy picture, you could lose custody of your child in a case. Or for men, if they've ever on Match.com said they don't have children in any setting when they actually do, they could lose custody based on that. You know, that's just one example where it's really come up in a very big way. But a woman lost custody of her young teen daughter to the dad because of something sexy the teen daughter had posted. Now, you know, she was just as likely to have posted it if she'd been in the dad's house. Judges are taking what's happening on social networks at a sort of face value that I don't think they should.
You've come up with at least one step toward a solution, something you call the social network constitution. Could you just quickly give us an overview of what the social network constitution is?
Sure. Well, it's the 225th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution, and I've suggested we need a social network constitution to make sure our online rights are in line with our offline rights. And one thing that interests me is that surprisingly, younger people actually do care about privacy. The Pew polls, their Center for Internet and Society, has found that people 18 to 30 actually have higher privacy concerns, 71% for the younger groups, as opposed to 56% overall. So as opposed to privacy of being dead, as some of the social network founders have said, I think it is very much alive, and now we just have to make sure that we protect it.
Laurie Andrews is the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. She spoke with Anstrain Champs. How do you define privacy? Is it simply a case of I know it when I see it? Maybe it's more a matter of, I know it when I see someone stalking me on Facebook. Garrett Keyser is a writer and contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He's also the author of Privacy. Keyser tells Steve Paulson how he would define it.
That is a complicated question, and the more I studied it, the more I realized that it was. Justice Louis Brandeis defined privacy as the right to be let alone. I'm not sure I found a definition that I like better, but I've certainly found many, and even I, as one person, one lay person defining it, don't always define it in the same way. I might call it a claim to one's existence over and against the overweening agendas of other existences, the right to have one's body, one's living space, one's own relationships and intimacies undisturbed, which sounds abstract, as many things that people say about privacy will, but in practice and experience usually becomes something very concrete and even associated with objects.
It sounds like you're suggesting then that it's more than just being let alone, sort of not being bothered. You want to expand the notion of privacy because there are various ways that our space, our life, might be invaded, infringed upon in ways that we don't even know about.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, a consideration of privacy leads us to a consideration of who we are as human beings and what we have a right to demand for ourselves and what we have an obligation to extend to others. As I was starting to say about the concreteness of privacy, one discovers that in very particular ways in a situation like a shared dorm space or a shared barrack space where suddenly there are three of you in one room. And this is my bed, and this is my girlfriend on the phone, so maybe you're going to go someplace else instead of listening in.
Now, you offer another definition of privacy in your book as a creaturely resistance to being used against one's will.
Yes.
Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from my thinking about privacy and realizing that violations of privacy, willful violations of other people's privacy, often comes, in my view, from looking at those people, viewing those people not as individuals equal to oneself and like oneself, but rather as objects or conveniences or things to be used, either for one's entertainment or one's amusement or to gain information. And so I think that the violation of privacy and the exploitation of other people are united or function together, but I also think that exploited people usually have less privacy.
Now, privacy is never actually mentioned in the United States Constitution, is it?
That's right, and many people are surprised to discover that. There is no word privacy in the United States Constitution. There are amendments like the Fourth against unreasonable searches and seizures and the Fifth against self-incrimination, from which a right of privacy has been derived by subsequent jurists. But there's no mention of the word privacy in the Constitution. I don't find that troubling. I tend to find it beautiful. I don't know if I find this beautiful, but there's no mention of gender equality or the illegality of slavery in the Constitution either, at least in the original document. But these things grew out of thinking about the Constitution. They evolved from it. The seed was there, I would say, and it came to flower. I think to say that privacy is a lesser right because it's not in the Constitution is like saying that a couple's child either does not exist or is not their child because he wasn't present at their wedding.
And you make the case that liberty and justice for all are necessary qualities for privacy.
Well, I certainly feel that they are. One needs liberty in the sense of personal choice and volition and self-determination for privacy to have much meaning. If you don't have freedom of choice, then privacy is not privacy any more than lovemaking in the presence of force is anything other than rape, or work in the presence of force is anything other than slavery. Privacy without liberty is just isolation and loneliness, and likewise, without justice, privacy is just a cloak for one's privilege or a cloak for one's misery. There's a flip side to that, though. which is that liberty without a respect for individual privacy just becomes a kind of anarchic dog-eat-dog pursuit of the will to power. And justice, and historically we've seen that, without a regard for privacy, tends to move the more zealous in the direction of totalitarianism. In my book, I say that privacy is the unspoken word in the Pledge of Allegiance.
How much is privacy a matter of social class, political class?
Well, I think in a system where there are social classes, just about any issue or value you can name is filtered through that. And certainly privacy is filtered through class, like other things that I would call goods, pizza pies, Mozart, privacy, whatever. The more money you have, the more of it you tend to have.
You can buy privacy.
You can buy privacy, and just think the way it's mediated in our culture. The busiest privacy brokers are the real estate agent and the lawyer. Lawyers help to litigate privacy breaches, and realtors provide you the home of your dreams where you can lock yourself away. Also, as I argue in the book, I think the meaningful exercise of privacy depends on having a private life. And if you're working three jobs to make a car payment and to buy your kids' clothes and to pay your rent, yeah, you have a right to privacy that's written somewhere and is in some legal text. But what private life do you have in which to exercise? It's like having freedom of the press when you're illiterate, when you can't read or write. And yes, you technically have a freedom of the press. You can write something for the newspaper or read something in the newspaper, but in reality, that right is not shared with you.
Now, my sense is that our understanding of privacy has changed quite a bit since 9/11. In a very concrete way, the Patriot Act of 2001 seemed to put some limits on privacy. What has changed?
Well, in my view, the change may have occurred before the USA Patriot Act rather than after it. One historian says something like 40 years of privacy legislation were rolled back by it. I think the change came about partly through fear, not just a legitimate fear of terrorists, but a fear of, on the part of our legislatures, of seeming to be less than tough on terror. I mean, the Patriot Act is a massive document, and it was put through Congress at a rate that argues strongly against the likelihood that anyone read it all that carefully. But we began to say or to think that in view of 9/11, that privacy was a luxury.
Right. I mean, the assumption is that there are bad people out there wanting to do harm to us, and we need some surveillance apparatus to keep tabs on them, to find them.
Well, I think it would be frivolous for me to argue that there aren't bad people out there and that we don't need perhaps stronger surveillance to catch them. But I'm always dubious whenever someone takes a right or a good, and to call that a luxury. I want to know who's calling it a luxury, whether they're giving up their own luxury, and what agenda lies behind their statement. In the case of privacy and terrorism, I think two points need to be made. First of all, terrorism is rightly seen as an attack on our way of life. But what I fail to see is how we can defend ourselves against that attack by joining with it in destroying our way of life, including our constitutional liberties. And second of all, I fail to see how a cult of compliance makes us better equipped to defend ourselves against terrorists. In other words, I'm willing to grant that there's a wolf at the door. I'm less willing to grant that turning a population into sheep will provide the best defense against the wolf. I would cite two what I see as related incidents, post-9/11 incidents, and one was the taking of Flight 93, where the passengers overpowered the terrorists. Mm-hmm. And then what would seem to some as an entirely different kind of act, where passengers refused to go into naked screening machines, virtual strip search machines. And you had a man named John Tyner saying, before a pat-down, you touch my junk and I'll have you arrested. And people saw that as an outrageous thing to do because of all of the terror threats. I would say that Mr. Tyner's action and the actions of the passengers on 93 were related. They both grew out of what I see as a very elemental right that we have, even an instinct we have, to being tampered with. Both were saying, Mr. Tyner and the passengers were saying, you are not going to do this to us. And if we lose the ability to say that, God help us in any time, let alone in an age of terror. We might as well sue for terms now.
Gerrit Kaiser is the author of Privacy. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of Kaiser's thoughts about privacy? How do you define it? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll find links to our Facebook page and Twitter accounts there. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll learn about the flip side of privacy, peep culture. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Hel Nidwiedzki is the author of The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. He says that in 2008, we entered a new era, the era of peep culture.
Peep culture is the evolution of pop culture. So in the past, we had our anointed celebrities, and they entertained us. They sang, they danced, they acted. All of that was scripted performance. In the age of peep culture, we are moving toward being entertained by our friends, our neighbors, our family, ourselves, in really unscripted performances that are generally based on the happenings of our everyday lives. So we have this move from the pop culture to the peep culture.
This is where we get to the word that really caught my attention, and that's overshare. It really is a key part of peep culture, isn't it?
Good old overshare, one of the new words of the year coined by Webster's a couple of years back. I think that overshare entered the popular lexicon for this very reason, that, hey, why are you telling me this? And there's this confusion about why people are suddenly going online and sharing the intimate details of their lives, whether it's their addiction problems or their sex life or their preferences or the fact that they just had a bowl of soup or they're heading to their spin class. This is the issue of overshare. And to me, it's emblematic of a real confusion about why this is happening.
Isn't it funny in a way, though, because we have this big deal about privacy. Everybody wants to maintain their privacy. And peep culture is really sort of the opposite of privacy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like the anti-privacy. You know, when I was thinking about this whole question of privacy as I investigated peep culture, what I really concluded was that people don't actually care all that much about their privacy. In fact, what people want is they want the ability to use their privacy as a commodity, or what they're learning about peep culture and its possibilities is that their privacy has a value and can be used as a commodity. So more and more, we're asked, for instance, to exchange certain aspects of our lives for a free service like Facebook. We go on Facebook, it's free. A lot of the people I talk to when I go to speak at a university or a high school, I'll say, why are you on Facebook? They don't really know why they're on Facebook. They don't know what the exchange that they are getting into actually entails. So we give Facebook access to our likes and dislikes, our comments, our pictures, all kinds of information, which they then pair with advertisements and amalgamate and sell in different ways. And we get something back, too. We get this free service called Facebook, which allows us to connect with all kinds of people in different ways. So this is a kind of privacy bargain that we're making. And as people get more into peep culture, they make bigger and bigger bargains. So, for instance, you might talk about someone who broadcasts their life 24 hours a day on the internet. And believe it or not, there are several thousand people across the U.S. who are doing that right now. And they're saying, here's everything. Here's all of my privacy. I completely disavow the concept of privacy, and I get something back in exchange, which is a much, much deeper sense of being constantly in the presence of others, communities develop, friendships develop, unorthodox relationships develop, and you might even be exchanging your privacy for that holy grail in the celebrity age, fame.
Boy, the thing about this that's so astonishing, you talked about how lonely we are as a society these days and how that has probably, more than anything else, generated peep culture. But to put your life on the internet for 24 hours a day, that seems like the very definition of TMI.
Yeah, I mean, you got your too much information, your overshare, all the rest of it. And that's the sort of knee-jerk criticism of this. But I really like to look at the underlying benefits and negatives. And what is this really saying about society and the people who are doing this? The loneliness aspect has much more to do with how we've structured our society into little suburban units connected to cars, connected to workplaces, the death of public space, the fact that we will now be moving around much more, disconnected from our families. We no longer have multi-generations living in a house in small towns. So you really do have this sense of the anonymous that hurts people and haunts them in ways that I don't think that they or our society at large fully understand. So along come these new technologies, and we're experimenting with them. We're reaching out through these new technologies to see if we can ameliorate some of the negative consequences of mass society. So I think we have to be a little bit more
tolerant of the experimentation.
Yeah, tolerant of the experimentation. A lot of people will go online and say, why are you doing this? You know, you're a fool. You're a loser.
But obviously they're looking or they wouldn't know that it was happening.
Well, that's the other thing is we're all implicated in this. It's very easy to dismiss people, for instance, who go on reality TV and parade around like lunatics. But we are also watching this in greater numbers. You know, to then go onto YouTube and post a comment below a video of a car crash and say, this isn't entertainment. You people are sick for watching this. Well, you just watched it.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, how much are we fooling ourselves? In the Peep Diaries, your book, you talk about how you held a party and invited your 700 Facebook friends to join you for a drink at a bar in Toronto. Well, I'll let you say what happened.
Well, it didn't turn out very well, unfortunately. And even though I had ultimately got a positive response, either saying they were coming or maybe coming from around 100 people, in the end, only one person came to my Facebook party, which was pretty sad and devastating and really did speak to what the medium is. You know, people talk about it as a loose connection, not a strong connection. When I was writing the book, I went to visit the guys who were at that time embarking on what is now known as Twitter. And I talked to them and I said, what is it that makes you really think that this Twitter thing is going to take off? Because at the time, they were considered sort of the lunatic fringe of peep culture. People said, who is ever going to want to do this? And they said to me, it's connection with low expectation. And that's what people want. And that phrase really struck with me as something that explains why we love peep culture so much, the idea of connection.
You've looked at this from the outside, of course, but you've also looked at it from the inside. You made a documentary you've called Peep Culture, which is the same thing as in the book, I guess. And I was astonished you went so far as to have cameras installed in your house, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were one of those people who let your life be seen, I don't know whether every minute for 24 hours a day, but for many of them anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite the event, to say the least. You know, I wrote the book, and then I met a documentary crew, a director and a producer who said, we love this book, we love these ideas, and now we want you to try it out. And I said, oh, God, really? This is not going to be good. But I couldn't resist, and I learned a lot from it. First of all, I learned that marriages are not as strong as you think they are. I'm still married, but just barely. When the cameras went into the house and my wife banished me to the basement so that I could sleep under the constant scrutiny of whoever cared to watch all over the world, things definitely took a very interesting turn.
Her attitude toward the cameras was a little different from yours, you're saying?
Yes. It was gradual where I'd said, well, we're just going to have one camera. And then it turned out we were going to have two cameras. And then as it turned out, we had about 10 cameras all over the first floor in the basement of the house.
And she didn't take the kids and move to Montreal for the period of...
Well, she certainly threatened to. And it almost came to that, and that's part of the reason the cameras had to go.
But what did it mean for you? You were willing to do this, and you, in fact, did live your life in front of the cameras. Did you find that it changed who you thought you were?
Very much so. And I came into it very skeptical, and I had this idea that I had already studied peep culture. I had already looked at its effects on people in society, and I wasn't going to get sucked into it. But very, very quickly, I got pulled into it. I was, for instance, absolutely obsessed with how many people were watching me. What kinds of actions and scenarios would spike my viewership? And this is something that I was really surprised by, because I had sort of scoffed at this and written about it in the book and said, you know, this is so sad that this woman, every time she writes a blog post, she comes back in an hour and checks how many people have read this and is despondent if she doesn't have, and that was her word, she's despondent if she doesn't have at least 100 readers. And yet there I was doing the exact same thing and going, oh, it was a bad day. Only a couple of hundred people tuned into the HAL broadcast today. What did I do wrong? And I would lie in my basement, unable to sleep at night, thinking up scenarios so that I could enact the next day. And
what did you find that worked best? I'm just curious.
You're going to really like this, Jim. The most popular camera by far was the bathroom cam, where you could get a very kind of hazy, not particularly revealing picture of my doings in the bathroom. And this camera would have a good solid 100 or so people always watching it. They were always watching this channel, no matter if I was in the bathroom or not. And they would talk amongst themselves. You know, they would sort of say, is anyone going to come in here? Who comes in here? What happens when the person enters this bathroom? And have these lengthy dialogues about what they were hoping to see.
In the film, at one point, you said, is there any point in living an undocumented life? It sounds as though you're saying, we like to have some documentation of our lives, but it's a question of how much documentation is going to satisfy your need.
If we move into the question of our lives being recognized, ourselves being noticed just for being ourselves, so we're not noticed for how much money we can make or what kind of weird habits and fetishes and strange hobbies we've come up with, but we're noticed just for being alive. This is the human yearning that really underpins peep culture. Why can't we have that? We should have that. We need to have that, but we don't really get that in contemporary society. So we struggle with what we are now being offered, which are these broadcast opportunities we've never had before. And I think that people do seek out attention, do want to be noticed, but I don't think that there is some inherent aspect of humanity that compels us to tweet. I don't think that's true. I think those things really come out of the systems of society that we've put in place, the pop culture that we grew up with that always told us, you know, you're important, you're great, you're fantastic, you can be a celebrity. And then all of a sudden comes new opportunities, new broadcast mediums that we never had before, where we could actually put that rhetoric in place. The story of pop culture, which has always been the story of you, suddenly becomes something that we can actually enact in our personal everyday lives. And so we go for it without really thinking about the consequences.
Hal Nidwiecki is the author of The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. What do you think of the idea of peep culture? You can share your thoughts with us via Facebook or Twitter. Or you can send us email via our website, ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll look at voyeurism as we conclude our hour on privacy. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Chuck Klosterman is a novelist and cultural commentator. His collection, Eating the Dinosaur, includes an essay about voyeurism, called Through a Glass, Blindly. It tells the story of the time Klosterman spent living in Fargo, North Dakota, as he tells Steve Paulson.
He used to live in this strange apartment. I guess the apartment wasn't strange, but it was constructed in a way that it was absolutely impossible to watch television without seeing directly in to the apartment across from me. And it was the same for this woman who lived in the other apartment. The way the windows were made and the way the place they put the cable hookup, if you were watching TV, unless you drew your blinds, I guess I could have done that or she could have done that, but you don't want to live and sit in the dark, you were always seeing into this apartment. And there's always been this belief that, you know, why do people like to, you know, like in Rear Window, like look into other people's lives? And everyone kind of takes for granted, well, it must be because we want to know other people's secrets, or, you know, we want to know how people live when the door is closed or whatever. And I think the reason it feels kind of exhilarating is because we don't know what's happening. The question in my mind most often when I would see in this woman's apartment would be, what is she doing now? Like, it never made sense to me. And I always realized there was the possibility that I could see anything, that there was no restrictions on what might happen because I didn't have a narrative of her life. It seemed as though I was always seeing something for the first time. Now, intellectually, that makes someone very tense. If you're playing cards, if you're playing blackjack and the whole game hinges on the next card, that's extremely stressful. But I think people who gamble would agree that's an exhilarating feeling.
Sure, there's this intensity. You never know what's going to happen. And to some degree, I suppose you're also making up stories that you think this might be part of. I mean, what you're watching.
The stereotype of somebody who's supposed to be a writer would be, I would look into this woman's apartment and I would see these glimpses of her life and I would create these narratives in my mind about who she was and what she did. But I never felt like I got close to that. I mean, I guess I could have done that if I'd seen her only once or twice. But because I was seeing it all the time, I would see this woman and she would see me all the time. It was like just having like a roommate who was incredibly quiet, who you'd sort of see moving around, doing these things. It just felt like unknowing, you know? And, I mean, that essay about voyeurism is, this is maybe kind of reductionist and kind of childish, but it's sort of that desire to unknow things. And how sometimes, how great it would be to go back and watch certain movies not knowing what happens, you know?
To be able to watch it for the first time again.
And just the physical sensation of anti-intellectualism, sort of not knowing. I spend my whole life trying to learn things. It's all I do. It seems like I'm trying to always learn everything I can, you know, and I suppose ostensibly to make my life better. But I wonder if you really lose a sense, a physical sense of this experience of being alive or whatever by understanding what's happening. I guess I like not knowing things.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of Eating the Dinosaur. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Marina Lutz never set out to be a filmmaker, but her short documentary, The Marina Experiment, has won awards at film festivals around the world. Marina Lutz talks about The Marina Experiment.
When I first discovered everything, I would have been 37. I had just moved back from Los Angeles, and I decided to clear out my storage space, which had all my parents' stuff in it. I came across all these boxes, boxes full of Super 8 film and reel-to-reel audio tape and loads of photographs, and my friend Jean was with me. She saw it as a treasure trove, whereas I was just in disbelief because I had no recollection of being filmed so much or being tape recorded. I didn't remember that at all. There was a Super 8 film of me when I was probably just before puberty. My breasts were starting to develop, and my father took footage of me with my head cut off. It looked like he was focusing on my developing breasts, and what I was doing was I had my cat in the shot, and I was basically torturing the cat, which I imagine was because I was trying to distract my father because I knew he was looking at my breasts. But, you know, I don't know how aware I was, if I was even present in that moment. In so many ways, it feels like I might have even just have left my own body when stuff like that was going on because I tend to still do that now when faced with something traumatic or distressing.
The idea of this tape is to tell us from the beginning to end everything that happened, not for us to know, but for you to know 10 or 20 years from now.
There's a series of photographs that he took of me potty training. And some people might look at these pictures taken out of context and just say, oh, those are pictures of a child potty training.
Well, first, Marina, I think you should go pee-pee.
All right.
All right? All right. I want to take a picture. Smile for me now. Atta girl. Oh, that's beautiful.
But for me, and the reason I use them in the film was because in that instance, and in quite a few others, there was repetitive photographing on his part of women's behinds. And when I looked at it, it was like I could feel him lingering on me longer than need be. That's what the pictures felt like. It was the male gaze that I felt from him when I saw the pictures.
What are you doing, Marina? Huh? Marina? Marina?
There was a picture of me when I was probably 13 or 14, where he made me pose in white cotton underwear in a hallway in our apartment. It was the hallway outside my bedroom. And I'm obviously extremely uncomfortable and very unhappy. You know, it was very inappropriate. Why would a father be asking his 14-year-old daughter to pose in her underwear so he can take a picture? I don't think that's right.
Stand over here. I want you to say something.
Hello.
Please.
Hello.
Don't, no. You're not supposed to touch those things, dear, remember? You're not supposed to touch the microphone. You know that?
Yeah.
You can't touch it. You got to just talk to it. You want to try again?
No.
No? Come here and talk to me.
I can't.
Come here. Sit here.
On the audio tapes, really was a lot of bullying.
I pledge allegiance?
Yes. I pledge allegiance.
Don't sit on the table.
Let who I nice.
Yes. And what else? Huh?
Pledge.
Wait a minute, start it again now.
And pledge allegiance.
I mean, the memories that I had were and are, continue to be visceral. So just hearing his voice and also hearing him constantly bullying me into doing things that I didn't want to do and hearing myself as this tiny little girl sort of weeping and not wanting to do things.
I don't want to sing.
In probably 2003, I started really going through the archive again and decided that in order to bring some of the material into my therapy, I needed to try to maybe use editing to put together little snippets that I could bring in and show my therapist so that she could understand how this stuff made me feel.
I understand Santa Claus said he wasn't going to bring you anything. Did he say that?
No.
What did he say?
He said, if I'm very good, he'll bring something to me.
All right.
I want to know if Santa Claus brought me a Chinese.
Wait a minute. Let's get everything ready. Oh, there's a letter.
Here's a letter. Look at what he said.
Oh, wait a minute. Dear Marina, I couldn't get you a Chinese dress in your size. I hope you will like all the other presents I brought you, Santa Claus. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess there's no Chinese dress. Because it doesn't come your size.
Why?
He says I couldn't get a Chinese dress in your size.
Oh.
Isn't that nice that he brought you a letter? Isn't that nice?
Maybe another Christmas day he could get me a Chinese.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Doesn't that card say that?
I got in really predominantly positive reaction from a lot of people. a lot of people that had had a similar experiences, which was just appalling to me, that were emailing me and continue to email me, thanking me for providing evidence for them that this kind of behavior exists and that this kind of thing is wrong. I've also gotten, not as much, but a certain amount of very angry correspondence from men who think I deserve jail time for the slander of my father and who think that I took innocent photographs and put them together in a way to make him look particularly terrible. I refer to everything in the archive as evidence because that's what it feels like to me. It's not documentation of a happy childhood. There's not one picture of my parents hugging me. There's not a film of them hugging me. There's no evidence of them ever holding me or loving me or caring about me. The pictures that are taken of me, I always am posed or looking extremely unhappy. So I guess it's evidence of a very sad childhood. I don't like the word victim, and I say that in one of the pieces that I wrote, that I prefer to think of myself as an opponent. Although, I don't know what other word to use. I guess I feel like a victim now in that I'm constantly coming up against the same challenges that I can't get past. I mean, really, all I really want, and I think it's what everybody wants in life, is to be loved. But I don't know how to let that love in, because my experience with that has been so negative that that it doesn't feel good when somebody actually cares about me. It feels terrifying.
Marina Lutz, on her award-winning documentary, The Marina Experiment. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Privacy. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.